As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide supports financial professionals with client-friendly resources and innovative solutions to help create greater retirement security for their clients. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
A bevy of banking news this week.
A bevy?
Yeah. We've got the change in leadership at Wells Fargo, of course, announced yesterday. Deutsche Bank's drama, the wrangling over its legal situation with the Department of Justice continuing. And then, of course, earnings out this morning, Tom, from three of the big banks, including Wells. We'll hear from Citigroup coming up. But J.P. Morgan releasing its quarterly report just minutes ago, the biggest U.S. bank.
Yeah, let me get that stock up here right now. We had it before, a little bit of a lift. But Christine Harper, quite impressed. I was blown away by the 13% ROE, return on an equity. We'll have some chat on that here with Mr. Hintz. Brad Hintz is at New York University. Of course, years covering the banking and financial industry with Sanford Bernstein. Professor Hintz, good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Well, I think I'm good. I don't know how Jamie Dimon's doing. Well, here on a Acclaim press conference and analyst calls as well. How badly does Mr. Dimon and other bankers need a steeper yield curve?
Well, it solves a couple of problems, right? It's not just steepness. If you notice, the yield curve actually moved up, so it actually went up across the entire curve. But steepness will help them on their investment portfolio, right? You know, I've got an investment portfolio. It's rolling off. I've got yield on that thing. As it rolls off, my net interest gets squeezed if rates are low and the yield curve is low and flat. As it starts to steepen, that solves one of the net interest margin problems. Of course, as the front end moves up, that helps my pricing in terms of loans. So that also helps me. So, you know, the market has been focusing on the poor banks, you know, with their net interest margins getting squeezed. This, you know, if the moves are the right way, you know, it'll take a lot of that pressure off them.
They bring in a dollar, they bring in 35 cents in operating income, which generates 22 cents in net income. I would suggest, Professor Hintz, that borders on cartel return. That's why are the banks so beleaguered if I'm making 22 cents on the dollar down at the bottom line?
Well, it's a lot better than than we've seen in the past, and you know, the banks have been struggling to beat their cost of capital. With luck, you know, this will be a somewhat better time for them going forward if rates continue to move in their direction. You know, the third quarters are always, you know, seasonally slower because the markets tend to slow down in the summertime, right? So when you sort of look on quarter-to-quarter comparisons, at least on the investment banking side, it's going to look a little bit funny. Right.
And David, I've got to compare and contrast here. Yeah. Bank of America operating income is 27, maybe 29 cents on the dollar, and J.P. Morgan is 35 or 36. That's in the game of finance, that's a big disparity in terms of profitability.
Pulling back, your fixed income trading at J.P. Morgan up 48% year over year, $4.3 billion, about a billion more than what analysts were expecting. Professor, put that into some broader context for us. You're going into earnings today, a lot of people saying this is what to look for. Look for the fixed income currencies and commodities.
Sure, and you know what we saw over the summer was, you know, there's been, you know, that we've had very good credit in the credit markets, good volumes in there. We've also had some positive movements in terms of credit spreads coming in. The, you know, Brexit and, you know, caused a lot of volatility. That's going to help in the govies and the sovereign side, and also going to pick it up in foreign exchange. So, you know, that's going to help the summer. So when you look at it, you know, last summer versus this summer, the year over year, it's going to look pretty good. When you start looking at some of the banks quarter over quarter, you're not going to see the same thing, but you're going to have to recognize that, you know, summer's always slow. This was a good summer for fixed income. And, you know, that's going to be the story that we're going to hear from these guys. The other issue you're going to hear is investment banking, right? And investment banking tends to be, you know, we're beginning to see a slowdown in investment banking.
We were talking with Axel Merck, the co-founder, of course, of Merck Investments. We were talking about money market fund regulations that go into effect today. What effect do you think that's going to have here on banks like J.P. Morgan?
Not significant. Everyone has seen that coming.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've seen an adjustment in terms of issuance of commercial paper, and that's actually affecting a lot in terms of the treasurers who do financing. The banks are going to have adjusted to that, and so you're going to see, you know, where you do your financing, the tenor that you do for your financing. It's not a surprise. I think most of the CFOs and treasurers in America are sort of well aware on this one.
Do the concerns about credit persist here? On previous conference calls, a lot of concern and consternation about energy credit in particular. Looking at the report that we got today, how much concern persists when it comes to credit and energy?
Well, we've seen the oil prices recover. That doesn't solve credit problems in terms of troubled companies. It takes a while for these things to work their way through. So it's going to be a continuum. People will ask questions, right? They'll push on it, but the immediacy is yeah. now gone, right? We know there was a fire there. We're watching it, right? It was when we saw smoke that the equity analysts began to get very troubled.
I want to go through four mumbo-jumbo ideas. We can do that with Professor Hintz. I'm in the back of the class running a C, and Professor, I got to get to a B-plus fast. Fortress Principles, tangible book, $51.23, up 8%, way out front of nominal GDP. Basel III, Tier 1 capital, $181 billion, 11.9%. Firm SLR, I have no idea what that is, folks. It's a camera, 6.6%. And I love this one, Brad. HQLA of $539 billion. All of this is footnoted, and Joe Evangelista is saving my butt today. Is this a fortress, or is that just a marketing campaign?
No, it's a fortress. You know, the JPM and you can say, you know, most of the banks at this point have fortress balance sheets. And, you know, we can... With luck, if you take this forward, the risk of the bank drops and you end up seeing the betas going down. That hasn't happened, right? And because if you want the betas to go down, that's going to reduce the cost of capital. And these, you know, the somewhat anemic ROEs that you've seen from the banks may actually end up, if they stay flat,
right.
If you know, you'll be beating your cost of capital. We're not there yet. There's still a lot of uncertainty on the banking side, but the credit risk to the banks has gone down. Right,
okay.
They're sitting there with a lot of liquidity on their balance sheet. They're sitting there with great capital positions. You know, that means that all of us can sleep well at night. That
right.
The banking system's stable. Now, whether you want to invest in them, that's a different question.
And Brad Hintz with us. Let's finish up here in J.P. Morgan and get Professor Hintz on with his day. Brad, tell me about retail banking. Mr. Dimon's killing it, clearly, within retail banking. And there's others doing it well, and some better, some worse. David and I walk by. David in Brooklyn. I'm in New York, in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And did I say that? And in Manhattan, when do the branches start closing down?
you've got some generational issues there, Tom, right? Which is, you know, I don't believe my 26-year-old son has ever visited a branch. He does everything electronically off of his cell phone. On the other hand, I go over to my little branch in New Vernon, New Jersey, and I know the people over there. So, the branch system has to be resized. JPM certainly is the dominant player in New York City. But you don't look only at the 20-year-olds, right? And you recognize that the elderly have all the wealth management. So keeping a few of those branches is probably a good idea.
Is the Boston merger-thon is just one example. The merger-thon of 20 or 30 years ago, did that work out?
What, for the banks as they rolled themselves up?
I mean, the Boston
Tom, you remember names like NCNB, right?
Yeah. Brad, I remember the Second National Bank of the United States. If they worked?
Not as well as people have had hoped, but they did work for some, and we do know that there's scale economics that exist in commercial banking. We still, as the United States, we still have a very, very fragmented banking system. Unfortunately, the large banks can't get larger, right? That's, the too large to fail problem. And so we're going to see a roll-up of this. It's not going to happen right away, but it is. We're not seeing new banks being made, right? So the looking forward, if you give a 5-year time horizon, you'd say that the banking world will continue to consolidate, but it's going to consolidate below the larger ones, right? It'll consolidate at that next tier.
Total credit card loans, J.P. Morgan, $133 billion. A few weeks back, our colleague Sam Grobart wrote a piece for Bloomberg Business Week about the Chase Sapphire Reserve card demand, incredibly high for this card, Tom, that has a special plunk factor. They actually put metal in the middle of it to give it a special feel to it. It's a wildly popular card. There is this competition, Brad, between Citi and J.P. Morgan when it comes to credit cards, in the credit card space. How important is that to this bank going forward?
Very important to Citi. Remember, Citi just did the Costco deal,
right?
And that's very, very good for them. Credit cards are important for all of these banks. It's a major source of profitability. Tough business, right? But it remains one of the few areas where you can get very nice net interest margin off of a portfolio. It's a core business of marketing, and I think JPM, we can say they've done a great job with the Sapphire card. Citi's going a somewhat different idea, which says we're gonna tie in with a Costco, a retailer, and pick up a portfolio that way. It's all scale.
Yeah. Brad Hintz, the scale for us is having you on. Thank you so much. Greatly.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Neil Dudd asked me this morning, how do you do this? And then he said, why do you do this? This is why I do it. Daniel Yergin walked in the studio this morning, and you'd think we'd speak with Dr. Yergin about oil. One of his cottage industries is to be one of our great economic historians. The beginning of his classic, The Commanding Heights on an England Flat on Its Back, is one of the great moments in modern economic literature. And we're thrilled that Dr. Yergin joins us this morning. Martin Wolf writes it up, Dan, in the FT today about this failure of May to be like Thatcher. You are truly one of the experts on this. Beveridge of the London School of Economics did a welfare study for England on want, disease, ignorance, squalor, and idleness. And out of that came the welfare state of England that Thatcher tore asunder. What is Prime Minister May trying to do now with the United Kingdom flat on its back?
Of course, Thatcher tried to open the economy, make it competitive, but the welfare state certainly continues and continues to be a very big part of the economy. So it hasn't gone away. I think Theresa May has a big problem, which is to define what is Britain going to be now? Now it's not going to be part of the EU. Is it going to be little England, or is it going to be global England? And some of the and she's responding to the same pressures that you see across much of the industrial world. Of course, here in the United States, this very vexing and challenging question of immigration and all the emotions around it.
I would suggest that Baroness Thatcher, with Keith Joseph, had a more organized, cohesive domestic politics to apply and to do. And that's absolutely right.
You know, that's absolutely right, Tom, because they had had several years to think this through, to work it through. She's improvising. She's inherited this hand now and basically has that the rules of the road just are not clear. So there's been no time to think it out. So as Martin Wolf points out, a lot of her rhetoric now is pulled from other places, even he suggests from Elizabeth Warren.
Just because of time here, let's, David Gura, have you switch over and talk about our American politics in the time that we've got with Dr. Juergen.
Yeah, I mean, it's been phenomenal to watch the last week unfold, the reporting in the New York Times, the story after story seeming to roll out here about Donald Trump, this campaign going off the rails more perhaps than it had been. You know, we were speaking with Stan Collender yesterday about the prospects for congressional action for something happening in Washington next year. He is, let's say, pessimistic on the subject. When do we return to a place where there is governance happening in Washington again, Dr. Juergen?
The question is, will we return to that? Well, yes, exactly. I think that people point out that when Hillary Clinton was a senator, she worked across the aisles and would be much, you know, works with people. And of course, right almost from the beginning, there was this gulf between the administration and Congress. We saw it most one example that we saw just very recently was on this bill that lifted sovereign immunity towards Saudi Arabia, and just a lack of communication. The day before the vote, the president sent a letter saying the results would be devastating for the United States, for our military personnel, our diplomatic personnel. But there was no traction until the very last moment.
I'm glad that you brought that up. Maybe we can get into oil a little bit here, Tom. I wonder what we've heard from the Saudis since that legislation was passed, since that veto by President Obama was overridden. Of course, there were the warning signs beforehand from the Saudis that if this were to happen, they would sell off treasuries and debt. What reaction have we seen? And moving to oil here a bit, you know, what does that do to the region having this this new law in place?
Well, I think it raises questions of whether the U.S. government is going to get sued by drone strikes, things like that. I mean, that's the big concern. And so you saw 28 senators after the legislation was passed saying, you know, maybe we've got to look at some aspects of it. I think this message from the Saudis was kind of shocked that it passed. They have a lot of other things on their agenda right now, particularly, I mean, this is a country that just invested $3.5 billion in Uber. Thinking through that. And meanwhile, of course, they're moving ahead with this huge Vision 2030 to remake their economy and no longer be dependent on oil.
Did you look at my script today? You say Vision 2030. Daniel Juergen, 3 years ago, power in 2030, of course, off your wonderful book, The Quest. Where will this nation be in 2030?
Our nation or Saudi nation?
Our nation.
Our nation. That's what is that? That's 14 years away.
It's called three more painful presidential cycles.
Well, it does raise the question of what are presidential elections going to be like in the future, and what lessons are going to be taken away from this campaign in terms of organization. You know, this is what we're seeing now unfolding is hardly anything that would have been imagined a year ago. And of course, when you travel in the rest of the world, people are kind of in shock watching this presidential election saying, what you're going to tell us about how to run a democracy.
Now, with your scope of economics and history, we had Michael Kazin on at Georgetown the other day on William Jennings Bryan. Do you look at this as a one-off event? Or is there a permanence to what we've seen, the tumult that we've seen within the Republican Party?
Well, I think that that obviously there are very powerful forces that have come to the fore, and these issues, I mean, what was the issue that really galvanized is immigration, even though apparently right now there is no net immigration coming from Mexico. So I think these forces are there. And the thing is, we do need higher economic growth. We do need inclusiveness and more entrepreneurial energy in our society, not just in Silicon Valley.
What a joyous surprise. Thank you for stopping by on a Friday. Daniel Yergin, I can't say enough about his most recent effort, The Quest. It is a synthesis of all that he's done and moves forward on this nation and our energy. Mr. Yergin, we almost were oil free then.
Yes, I'm sorry.
We'll do that next time.
I brought us
Daniel
there.
Yergin.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role as to serve, not sell. That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
We need to go to Boston. And Michael McKee at a very important summit at Tufts University. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Tom. And the good news for you is the Boston Bruins opened the season with a 6-3 win. Brad Marchand scores 2 goals, gets 3 assists to open the season. That's your report from Boston that I knew you wanted to have.
Got that right.
We're here with Admiral James Tremitas, our old friend, the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and they are hosting a conference today on the future of Greece. It's Greece's turn, and we welcome the Admiral to the program. We came up for the conference because, of course, it's always great to talk to you about national security issues, and Greece has it's been a financial crisis for the world. But you also look at it, and you told us this before, that it is a major national security issue given its geographic location.
Exactly. You know, we're talking sports a minute ago. Think about baseball. Think about the hot corner, the third base. Greece is kind of the hot corner for Europe. It's the closest to the batter in terms of offensive action. And so Greece is going to be the canary in the mine shaft in terms of refugees, terrorism. They're in a very precarious position, and we need to stand with Greece, and that's part of what this conference is about.
One of the questions that people have is, we went into the crisis in 2009, and in 2010 they started with rescue plans, and they're still not out of it, and things still seem to be deteriorating. I know you've been meeting for a day already on this. Have you come to any conclusions as to why?
Well, it is a conference about Greece, so you'll allow me to reach into Greek mythology. One, it's like Sisyphus. You kind of roll the boulder up, you make progress, but it seems to kind of keep coming back down. And the other one, less well known, is Tantalus, who was tied to a tree, punished by the gods, and dying of hunger and thirst, and the wind would blow apples almost within his reach, and the water would raise almost to his lips. So I think we've got a little bit of Sisyphus and a little bit of Tantalus going on. But I was in Greece a week ago, and I think we are beginning to turn the corner there. I think we are going to see positive growth numbers there next year. Small, tiny, but positive.
Well, one of the things people worry about with Greece's geographic location is obviously the introduction of bad guys into the region. In the early days of the crisis, there was a lot of talk about bringing in loans from China, bringing in loans from Russia. Never happened. What's the Greek feeling about the United States and about these other actors? They've never been a particularly great friend of the United States, but they haven't allied themselves with the other side either.
Yeah, I think if you look at the long relationship of Greece with the United States, it's overall pretty positive. And I'll stipulate I'm a Greek American, so I'm predisposed to think that way. But remember, our values come from Greece. We have a long history of supporting them in independence. We have a World War II history with Greece. And to answer the question of how it is today, I'd say it's a mixed picture. There are a number of people in Greece who would like to see closer alignment with Russia, for example, Mike, because of the Orthodox connections there. But I think overall, Greece stands with the West, stands with NATO, and stands with the United States.
Well, NATO is a big question, of course. You got Turkey right across the Bosporus there, which at one point was thought to be the next candidate to join the European Union and now seems to be moving away. How do you assess what's going on with Turkey and the region?
We have a president in Turkey, President Erdogan, who is consolidating power as a chief executive. This coup has actually helped him because it's given him the opportunity to purge numerous political and military opponents to his regime. He himself is drawing closer to Russia. So I think Turkey is going to be a problematic ally, but I'm confident over time we can keep Turkey in the transatlantic orbit. And you're right to say we've moved away from a spot in the European Union for Turkey. But I think over time you'll see them come back because the other options really aren't that good for them. Long term, they don't want to be aligned with Russia and its undoubtedly failing economy in the 21st century.
But they've been making awfully nice with Vladimir Putin lately.
They have, and that's a function of Erdogan's desire to appear very strong internally, his displeasure with the United States over our support for the Kurdish rebels, and our reticence in returning this Gulenist cleric who has taken refuge here in the United States, and Erdogan thinks he led the coup. Those are tactical challenges. I think long-term, Turkey's strategic future is with Europe and with the United States. It'll play out that way. May take us a few years to get there.
Let me ask you, as long as you brought up the Kurds, quickly, we got about a minute left here. Iraq, where are we with that? There's talk of the U.S. arming the Kurds. That just brings in Turkey into it. It seems like we're not any closer to any kind of solution there.
It's a tough puzzle to put together. On Iraq, we're vastly better than we were a year and a half ago when the Islamic State was on the gates of Baghdad. Now they're pushed back. We're going to take Mosul back in the next 6 months. I think the long-term future for Iraq is a decentralized government. The Kurds are going to have a fair amount of authority, but I think Iraq holds together as a national entity.
Beats go on this morning when it comes to banking. We had J.P. Morgan first, followed by Citi and then Wells. I'm bringing Eric Ogier. He is U.S. Banks Analyst with CFRA joining us now. And Eric, I wonder if you could just draw a line of distinction for us here. How this, the third quarter, seems to be shaping up compared to the second. What's changed here over the last quarter?
Well, it's actually relatively similar to the second quarter. Recall that in the second quarter, expectations were extremely low because of the losses that were recorded in the first quarter. And most of the U.S. banks, certainly the largest ones, beat on top and bottom line. So what we're seeing this morning is the same thing. The four major banks that reported this morning have all beaten on top line and bottom line expectations, which were relatively low going into this quarter.
What are we seeing in terms of credit? I wonder, when you look at these banks' credit portfolios, are there points of any concern for you when you look at, say, commercial lending, or you look at student loans? On the credit side of things, what are you most focused on or most worried about?
Well, in credit, we're most focused on, as is everybody, on consumer lending, particularly auto and credit cards. And there is some slight deterioration, but we see trends as relatively stable. One data point is that J.P. Morgan Chase is building up its reserves for cards, but they say they're doing that because of growth, not deterioration. But our job as analysts is to dig into that a little bit. So credit quality peaked probably a couple of quarters ago.
Eric, your job is to be stock picker of the year in 2009 for Standard & Poor's, which is a unique skill set, folks. Very different. There's research of a company and their relative performance to a group. And then there's just the cardinal thing of buy, hold, sell. How buy-y, hold-y, sell-y is the bank group right now? Do you have a real vision of where the bank group will be 12 months or 36 months out?
Well, we have buy recommendations on all of the top U.S. banks. We think they're slightly undervalued on a P.E. basis relative to where they've been in the past. We think that they will continue to improve. Loan growth is relatively strong. The returns of capital are improving. As long as the U.S. economy slowly grows, we think that they can take global market share.
Let me ask you my money question, which is, can you model the single digitness of their dividend growth. Are they going to be subpar, mid-par, or are they really going to, you know, add a dividend growth above revenue growth, above nominal GDP?
I think that their dividends will start to accelerate in growth. And one of the reasons is that the original 30% cap that the Federal Reserve had, I know its banks were really not supposed to pay out more than 30% of normalized EPS, and it looks like that cap is starting to be relaxed. So perhaps they can go up to the 40% range. So that should certainly help with dividend growth going forward. And yes, we see dividends growing faster than GDP.
We had this fixed income trading slump, went on for a while. Now it seems that we've come out of that, loudly, it seems like, when you look at J.P. Morgan, especially here. Do you think that's going to continue for some time?
No. I think from what I heard on the JPM conference call that is underway right now is that Q4 will moderate. So Q2 and Q3 were large outperformances in terms of trading. Some of that was due to the Brexit volatility, and some of it was due just to what the results were a year ago as a comparison. Comparisons are easing, but the results in trading were far better than expected.
Do you have a single best buy right now?
We have a strong buy recommendation on the shares of Citigroup, and that's based on,
Do they just close the ROE gap? Is that what that's about?
Yeah. I mean, their ROE is so far below peers. It's around 6%, while JPM is 10%, Wells Fargo is 12%. So we think they're closing the gap, and that it just takes many, many years to keep building the ROE. But as the legacy Citi Holdings assets wind down, we think the ROE growth will accelerate.
David Gura, we need to bring the show to a screeching halt. 9:03:28 this morning, a missile from the Secretary of Treasury to one D. Gura, U.S. Treasury Department, Office of Public Affairs, immediate release. Do I understand that they've lifted the ban on Cuban cigars?
The ban on importation of Cuban origin merchandise as accompanied baggage for personal use.
Not only will you be able to smoke Cuban cigars, but you can dip them in your Cuban rum before you smoke.
There you go. They have lifted the value limitation on alcohol and tobacco products. Persons subject to U.S. jurisdiction will be further authorized to import Cuban origin merchandise acquired in third countries into the U.S. as accompanied baggage. So yes, Tom, your read is correct. Cigars and rum.
The individual can bring them back. Or can we send the surveillance golf stream down there and fill
it
up?
Hold
it
up.
Clear
the runway at Havana Airport.
I remember Bay of Pigs vaguely. I remember the silence in the house. I don't remember the details, but it's amazing to see this. This is from the Secretary of Treasury, Jacob J. Liu. The Treasury Department has worked to break down economic barriers in areas such as travel, trade, and commerce. He goes on to say, and we hope there'll be an American bank on every corner. Eric Hoha with the CFRA on banking. Eric, what does the opening of Cuba mean for our American international and, frankly, Florida regional banks? Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I think that would probably be a relatively small benefit.
But symbolic.
Yeah, perhaps symbolic, but it's a small country, and maybe for, like you said, for regional banks that are in the Florida area.
We're a small country. Cuba's a small country. Eric, there are five banks on every corner in New York City. When does this silliness end?
Well, we have seen some rationalization taking place. One of the most aggressive ones is J.P. Morgan Chase. They are closing a lot of the legacy branches that they have. I mean, keep in mind that they're a combination of Chase Manhattan, Manufacturers Hanover, Chemical, Bank One. So they can close a lot of legacy branches. And I think that we're also seeing that from Toronto Dominion, They are closing a lot of the old Commerce Bank branches. So, no, I think, and also with Fifth Third, they announced the closure of 100 branches. So I think that we have seen the high water mark in U.S. bank branches.
How about the transition to digital? I'm looking at the Wells report out this morning. Customer visits with branch bankers fell 10% in September compared with the previous month. Looking at the number of people who opened consumer checking accounts, that dropped 30%. And a note here in the Bloomberg News story, Wells did not give a cause for the declines. How are these big banks handling that transition to the digital space?
Well, I think they're handling it extremely well. The larger banks have the resources to build up their digital presence. PNC and TD have been leaders there. Yeah. I think also JPM. And in the longer run, that's a lot less expensive than keeping open expensive branches and paying people. They also have cut the number of people in each branch. Less people are needed as technology improves.
Do you perceive that a regional could do mergers and become a mega big bank? Like, does PNC with operating income of $5, maybe $6 billion, do they aspire to approach JP Morgan's $32 billion of operating income?
I don't think that they want to go up there. And that's simply because the liquidity and capital requirements will be so tremendous when they get up there. I mean, the fifth largest bank in the country is U.S. Bancorp. Let's put it this way. PNC has assets of $370 billion, which is well below the big four, which are around $2 trillion. And that's simply a function of liquidity and the higher capital ratios that are demanded.
Eric, thank you so much. Eric Wahlberg, just brilliant today with CFRA and on the banking business. We'll have much more on this. Citigroup, you heard him say Citigroup was his best buy. I didn't know this, David Gura, in researching the important announcement from Treasury on trade with Cuba. President Kennedy's favorite cigar was the H. Upman, this according to The Observer, the night before he signed the embargo in 1962.
Smoke them while you got them.
He asked one Pierre Salinger to go out, the acclaimed Pierre Salinger, to go out and buy every box in Washington.
Pierre Salinger was the first one on the beach of the Bay of Pigs to get the cigars, get back before they started.
And the brutal guy who's looking at the new Cuban cigars of 2016 says they are so mild that you want them to age 10 or 15 years.
Our first cigar review.
I don't know. You know, that's a big deal, folks. And what everybody can say, it's been a lifetime, David, of Cuba over there.
The White House issuing a statement on this as well. President Obama, who was in Havana recently, saying these changes representative of the progress I saw firsthand when I visited Havana to personally extend a hand of friendship to the Cuban people. That quick flight over 90 miles of blue water belied the real barriers of the past that were crossed that day. So, yeah, some real movement here.
It's just
to cigars and rum.
It's like on a formal report, and I can't concentrate. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at CedarPoint.com.